The Pre-Paces podcast is brought to you by two brilliant sponsors. Paces Ahead is a fantastic four-day face-to-face Paces course run in Brentford, London. They bring you a whole host of patients with fascinating stories and reliable signs, and these patients are absolutely delighted to allow you to hone your exam skills prior to exam day. Some of the patients actually are used in the exams themselves, and the next courses are running from the 20th to the 23rd of May, and then I will be helping out on the course running on the 28th to the 31st of May. Please do come and say hello. I'd love to have a chat and hopefully help you on your way to passing your paces. But if you can't make the course for whatever reason, our other sponsor, Pass Test, has got you covered with their market-leading online revision resource. There are tons of videos which help you revise from the comfort of your own home, and most listeners that I've spoken to have said this is equally essential for your paces success. But that's enough for me for now. Let's get into this week's episode of the Pre-Paces podcast. Welcome, listeners. Dr. Sam Williams here, and welcome to this hotly anticipated episode on splenomegaly. I'm pretty sure this is one of the most hated scenarios for paces, so I'm really delighted to bring it to you. I got along another brilliant returning guest, Dr. Susie Morton, consultant haematologist who you may remember from the polycythemia episode. One thing that I recommend before listening, if you can, is to look through the life cycle of a lymphocyte. I just think it would be really helpful to process the content from this episode rather than going in cold. But now to pay homage to the donation heroes on the Buy Me A Coffee page. Firstly, to Ben, thank you for your kind words and donation. Thank you to Hayley and to Man. Thank you to Alice, listening on her commutes through the Mersey Tunnel. And thank you to James for your kind donation as well. But I absolutely loved Jake's message, who found himself humming the theme tune on the morning of his exam. That's absolutely everything I want to hear. And we've got everything crossed for your results as well, Jake. And thank you to everyone who has donated. But for now, on with the show with Dr. Susie Morton. Welcome to the Pre-Paces podcast. My name's Dr. Sam Williams, and for regular listeners, they will know that I think long and hard about who I invite on the show to discuss each specific topic. And this episode is no different. I thought long and hard about who might be best to provide an insight into assessing and managing patients with splenomegaly. Maybe I should pick an acute medical consultant skilled at rapidly examining patients and eliciting clinical signs. Should I pick an infectious disease specialist and let them preach to us about how important it is to send thick and thin malaria films? Or do I pick a loved and cherished friend of the podcast who is as much of a Taylor Swift fan as I am? There was only one choice. It's consultant haematologist, Dr. Susie Morton. Susie, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Sam.
And Susie, I've invited you back. And as we was just saying before we hit record, between us, we think this is probably one of the harder, if not the hardest topic to tackle in paces. And I said that I'm allowed to say that because this came up in my very first unsuccessful paces attempt. But this really is a huge potential banana skin. And this is why it's so important for our listeners to get this absolutely right, isn't it?
Absolutely. I agree. I mean, the difficulty with splenomegaly is there are so many different things that can cause it, and you kind of have to have them all in your mind as you approach the patient, even aside from the fact that it's quite difficult to feel beans clinically and that you don't come across them every day. And I think it would be remiss of me not to admit that as a haematologist, it's one of my least favourite things to see in clinic, just because actually it can be really difficult to get to the bottom of and find out exactly what's going on in the patient. So if it's any consolation to the listeners, I share your pain.
And Susie, one thing I wanted to ask as well is, as a jobbing haematologist, how often do you actually come across patients with splenomegaly in your own clinical practice?
Yeah, it's really reasonably common, actually. So probably, I don't know, 1 in 10 referrals that we get will be a big spleen. And I know we're going to talk a bit more about, you know, how people present and how they come to be with us. But the difficulty often with splenomegaly is it's seen incidentally on imaging. And actually what constitutes a big spleen. So they will probably talk a little bit about definitions and things. But yeah, the ones on the borderline can be even more difficult to manage, because how far do you investigate them if your first round or second round of investigations haven't yielded anything of particular note?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a huge investigative rabbit hole you could dive down in your discussion with the examiners. But for now, I think it's only right. Let's get into our conversation on splenomegaly. So, Susie, just starting off, I'm wondering, it's got a pretty straightforward definition, but what's your definition of splenomegaly?
Yeah, so you're quite right. A big spleen will be defined as anything more than 13 centimetres on imaging, but also clinically, if you can feel the spleen, it's too big, which is actually quite a useful clinical parameter because, as we say, a lot of these patients are picked up on imaging and the 13 centimetres does not allow for your 4'10" woman versus your 6'6" man. And certainly I have had patients who are very, very tall men, and you think, well, actually, how significant is this 14 or 15 centimetre spleen? So it has to be taken into consideration, and there are no good rules or guidelines. Without wanting to go into too much detail too soon, you can think about things like, well, what's the impact of the big spleen? So, for example, if someone's got a slightly low platelet count and you think that's because they've got a big spleen, then that big spleen must be pathological, if you see what I mean, a physiological big spleen or physiological normal for that person size spleen should not cause things like a low platelet count. So as with all of medicine, you're having to take lots of different things into consideration. But the bottom line is 13 centimetres or something that you can feel clinically.
And we've been discussing the potential vignettes that might be presented to our listeners. And overwhelmingly, my feeling is this is the type of thing which comes up in an abdominal examination station. It's possible it could come up in the clinical consultation station, but I think the biggest anxiety and apprehension from a lot of people I've met, or PACES sitters, prospective PACES sitters, is the abdominal examination station. Before we dive into the actual examination process, you mentioned about trying to think about the function of the spleen and think about why the spleen would be enlarged for any given reason. And I think this is really important because it's better than just rote learning a list of diagnoses. It cements it more in the mind of us all to understand the reasons why the spleen is enlarged and then categorize it that way. So I wonder if maybe you can just go through a few of the common categories of why spleens might be enlarged, and then maybe just tell us why those categories exist and are distinct from one another.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as we go through the different causes, we can then sort of relate them back. So this isn't going to be completely exhaustive, but I think generally speaking, it's helpful to think about, what's in the spleen and what does the spleen do. So the spleen is basically full of lots of different types of lymphocytes at various stages of differentiation. So if your lymphocytes are going bananas, you can get a big spleen. So lymphoma, very kind of common example. And you might get a lymphoma that is just affecting the spleen, or more commonly, you'll get a lymphoma that affects the whole of your lympho-reticular endothelial system. So it would be associated with lymphadenopathy. So the spleen is an honorary lymph node. So anything that makes a lymph node big can make the spleen big. And that includes sort of primary problems with your lymphocytes. Your lymphocytes might be cancerous, lymphoma, or your lymphocytes might be reacting to an infection or to some other stimulating problem, so something like sarcoid. So you're then sort of thinking of your kind of multi-system disorders where you're going to get a lymphocyte response. So basically, too many lymphocytes in your spleen, big spleen, could be cancer, could be something else stimulating it. Then you've got to think that the spleen is quite a nice place for hemopoiesis to happen. It happens in the fetus. It doesn't happen in health in adults, but it's the next best place after the bone marrow. So if either there's something going on in the bone marrow that the bone marrow can't exist there, so you've got, lots of fibrosis in the bone marrow, then the next place that the hemopoiesis is going to go is the spleen. So that's going to be your kind of myelofibrosis situation, which people, I'm sure, will recognise as one of the causes of a massive spleen. But then also on the same theme, it might not be that the bone marrow is full of something else, but it might be just that the bone marrow can't do enough to keep up. So that's going to be like your hemolytic anemias, for example, where you need to produce, 10, 20, 100 times because it's being destroyed peripherally and your bone marrow just can't keep up. So your bone marrow is maximum capacity. So it looks for the next best place to dump some extra hemopoiesis, and that's your spleen. So you're going to get splenomegaly in those situations. And then you're kind of thinking of, well, what else is going on in the spleen that might make it big? Well, it's kind of plumbed into all of the abdominal vessels. I'm not a liver physician, as you'll find out very quickly. But if you've got liver problems, you then get your portal pressure and your back pressure on the spleen is going to get congested and big. And those are the kind of things that I'll be thinking about when I'm thinking about someone with a big spleen. And that kind of just helps to guide you as well in terms of what else you're looking for on examination and other clues that might be pushing you in one direction or another, depending on what else you find or any other information that you get from the history.
Yeah, absolutely. And so under one big umbrella is just hematological causes, and that had more symptoms and probably more causes than any of the others. So that's, you know, one of the main sort of categories that I've put splenomegaly under. And then congestive was the other, as you mentioned. And then the other one is in infective, which is, you know, again, why I mentioned about an infectious disease specialist. But again, that is a relatively uncommon cause. And then below that, I've got sort of relatively rare, I don't know, maybe rare to me because I don't see it, Susie, but maybe you see it certainly more, probably more than I do. But inflammatory causes, so autoimmune causes, and then infiltration, which, it, you know, includes all the very rare stuff, which we'll come on to towards the end. But again, these are the types of patients that they like to bring out in PACES. So anything can come up, but I guess just important to think about how to approach your station depending on your vignette as well. I guess we should also talk about the presenting symptoms, because when our candidates walk into the bed space, they're going to say, this is Mr. or Mrs. Jones. This is their presenting symptom. So what type of symptoms do you think would raise a flag for our listener in terms of thinking about each of those categories in turn?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is probably a little bit where life differs from the exam. So I think in the exam, if you're told that someone has got fevers, sweats, and weight loss, you know, that's a clear signpost that somebody thinks the patient's got a hematological malignancy. I would love if patients with hematological malignancy presented with those features, you know, commonly, but usually when we see them in clinic, they haven't got that. If they're being admitted acutely to the ward, then maybe, but just kind of bearing in mind that that's a sort of a code in a way. In terms of the actual spleen itself, usually big spleens are asymptomatic, but if you are going to get symptoms from a really big spleen, it's going to be symptoms like early satiety. The spleen obviously sits right behind the stomach, so as it gets bigger, it's going to squash the stomach, which means you can't eat very much because the stomach can't expand. And then you can get left upper quadrant pain if the spleen is enlarging very quickly, or it's actually more common in terms of spleen pain to get that if the spleen is infarcting, which can occur if the spleen's getting big quickly. But generally speaking, most spleens present in an asymptomatic way, but you've then got to be mindful of symptoms of the underlying cause. So say your sort of your B symptoms, if you're thinking about an aggressive high-grade lymphoma or some other types of hematological malignancy. And then, you know, we can talk more about symptoms of liver disease, symptoms of hemolytic anemia, and all sorts of other things that might come up.
Fantastic. Fine. So I think let's move into our examination of the patient in front of us. So we've talked about the vignettes, we've talked about the categories that we have to think about splenomegaly in the context of. But again, until you feel that spleen, that's probably the first time you're going to have to then sort of backtrack and think, well, which bucket am I going to put my splenomegaly in? But we'll come to that at the end of the examination. So our listeners are going to approach the patient and then they're going to perform an end of the bed examination. So Susie, is there any, what sort of signs can our listeners expect to find at the end of the bed when they see these patients that they possibly may go on then to examine and find a large spleen?
Sure. So again, it's going to completely, unfortunately, depend on the underlying cause. If you're looking at your hematological causes, you might notice that they're pale in association with being anemic. They might have petechiae or, you know, obvious bruising to constitute a low platelet count. I'd hope that patients that were properly pancytopenic, that you could see the symptoms or the signs, would not be in a PACES station. But in theory, you might see that, and you're obviously not going to see very many signs in terms of a low white cell count. So that's a bit more tricky. If you're looking at your liver disease patients, although rare that you get a palpable spleen in liver disease, you often get a radiologically enlarged spleen, but rare to get a palpable spleen in liver disease, but you're going to get all of your features of chronic liver disease that we probably don't need to go into now. And then really just looking for any other features. You know, you mentioned things like autoimmune diseases, so there could be joint swellings, rashes. Really there's no end to the things that you might see that might be relevant.
Yeah, it's extremely hard to be specific, which is why so many people find the station so difficult. I guess the other end of the bed thing is if they're either sat up or laid down, you may well see that they've just got quite a large abdomen, and you may see that there is a greater enlargement on the left upper quadrant, possibly. Oh, but again, that's only if it's a significant swelling, either moderate or massive, probably.
Absolutely. And in practice, I'm trying to think whether I've ever really seen that. And usually when you get it, if you've got a really enormous spleen in someone that's cachectic, which again, it would be a quite unusual patient that was suitable to be in an examination in that situation. I mean, I have seen somebody present with new CML whose spleen was so big you actually couldn't feel the spleen because the spleen edge was in the right iliac fossa. And it was just like this patient had a really hard abdomen. You just thought, why is the abdomen so hard? And it's all like his white cell count is 300. That's probably why. And he had CML that did not end well, as you could imagine. But yeah, so looking for the spleen on inspection is very rare that you would see that.
Yeah. And then moving to the hands. Now, truthfully, I haven't found an awful lot to suggest, you know, hard signs of pathology in the hands. We talked about autoimmune causes and particularly things such as Felty syndrome, which I think can occasionally come up in paces, which obviously you won't be able to see their white count, which is the other thing which is associated with Felty's. But if you do see signs of rheumatoid arthritis, then there's a possibility you may be finding the spleen. It's quite unusual to find rheumatoid in an abdominal station otherwise, isn't it?
It would be unusual, but actually that's probably one of a small number of fairly good examples of someone with a stable spleen that would be suitable to come to a PACES examination where treatment wouldn't make the spleen go away, you know, depending on what was planned for that person and where they would have signs that would fit. So yeah, I think definitely watch out for that. And then that's a beautiful finding, isn't it? Because you can put the two together and then you can ask for the full blood count that's going to clinch your diagnosis. So yeah. Less common in clinical practice, or certainly for me, because they tend to go to rheumatology first, but we do pick up the odd one when they come to us with, usually it's the neutropenia that prompts the hematology referral.
Yeah, absolutely. And the only other thing which I have got down for the hands are the signs of chronic liver disease, as we've already mentioned. So things like palmar erythema, asterixis and clubbing. So we can go through all the signs of liver disease, but what I'm going to suggest to the listeners is if they haven't already gone back and listened to episode number 67, with consultant hepatologist Dr. Phil Berry, that they go back and do that, because that will detail all the pertinent signs of chronic liver disease, which are also relevant for this station. So that will just, we will touch on them as we go through. But if you want a comprehensive guide to chronic liver disease, then go back and listen to that one as well. So we talked about the hands. And then going up the arms, Susie, I mean, the only thing I've got is just evidence of bruising, which might be, I mean, due to deranged clotting, low platelets, and they can also be a result of chronic liver disease as well.
I mean, I think it's fine to mention the bruising and to consider whether it's due to a low platelet count, but I would consider it due to a low platelet count rather than to a clotting problem, because your coagulation system, except for a few very minor exceptions, notable but less relevant for PACES exceptions, is not related to your blood cells, your hemopoiesis, your lymphoid system in any way, shape or form. So yeah, if you see bruising, talk about platelets, but don't talk about coagulation per se.
Fantastic. And then moving from the arms, we're going up to the face and neck, and lymphadenopathy is something that's really important. So Susie, where would you specifically examine a patient for lymph nodes?
Yeah, so I think in the context of PACES and the abdominal system, I think it's part of your basic examination would be to feel for cervical lymphadenopathy. You'll want to show that you're examining the anterior chain, the posterior chain. You're going up right behind the ears and you're coming across the top of the clavicles as well. Of course, you're going to be thinking about your Virchow's node in terms of your gastric malignancies, but that will give you a good idea as to whether the patient has got, you know, widespread lymphadenopathy. For me, as a haematologist in clinic, almost every single new patient I see, I will examine their neck, their axillae and the groins. But I think in the setting of PACES, as we've said, you don't know whether you're going to find a big spleen until you get there. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to do the cervical lymph nodes, do your abdominal examination. And then if you find a spleen, you can go back and do the axillae and the groins. And the way that I tend to examine the axillae is a bit like you would for a breast examination. Although, to be honest, I tend to do it with the patient lying down. I hold their arm, ask them to relax their arm into my arm and have a good rummage around on both sides. So that's what I would do as my sort of lymph node examination.
brilliant. And moving then from the, well, part of the face and neck, I guess, is looking into the eyes as well. And one question I had is whether or not scleral jaundice is something which would be suggestive of a hemolytic anemia, or whether that's something we would only associate with chronic liver disease.
Yeah, so you very much can see jaundice in people with hemolytic anemia. I guess it's rare to see a bilirubin of over maybe 120, but definitely high enough to see clinical jaundice. And although it doesn't affect the sclera, the other thing to bear in mind is that if you've got somebody with hemolytic anemia, they're also going to be anemic and a bit pale. And if you add the pallor of the anemia with even a bit of mild jaundice, people can look pretty yellow. And certainly with some of my patients with autoimmune hemolytic anemia, you know, you can tell when you walk past them in the waiting room before you've even looked at their bloods, whether they've relapsed or not. So yeah, clinical jaundice is definitely a thing in hemolytic anemia.
Fantastic. And then moving down from the face and neck to the chest. Now, Susie, the only things I've got for the chest are things related to chronic liver disease. So we can signpost our listeners back again to episode number 67 with Dr. Phil Berry to look for those signs. But was there anything else in the chest before we come to examine the abdomen, which is pertinent from a hematological or spleen related perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing which hopefully is less relevant for the exam, but I'll mention for the sake of completeness, would be your patient that's got a high grade, usually lymphoma expanding rapidly and causing SVC obstruction, where you might get lots and lots of lymph nodes in the chest and a big spleen as part of it. Now, hopefully that patient is not going to be in the exam for everybody's sake, including the patients, but just for the sake of, you know, looking at the whole picture and from a clinical, you know, acute take presentation as well, it's important to bear that in mind.
So then we get to the meat of the sandwich, the main part of the examination, which is examining the abdomen. And this is going to be where our candidates can either make or break their station. And so this is why it's so critically important that they get it right. Now, we are going to focus very much on the spleen, because that's obviously the topic of this episode. But obviously, it's important to go through the motions of your examination. So you're going to palpate superficially for tenderness, and then you're going to palpate more deeply for masses. And then you're going to go into your specific organomegaly assessment. We went in detail through examining for hepatomegaly with Dr. Berry as well. So we're going to focus straight on the spleen. Susie, what are the best tips you can give our listeners as to the best way for them to reliably detect splenomegaly in a patient which may be presented to them?
So I think the first thing is you've got to believe that there might be a spleen there, which might sound a bit silly, but I think it's very easy to go through the motions, isn't it, of feeling for organomegaly. And actually, if you're not really concentrating in your mind's eye and thinking, is there a spleen there? Is there not a spleen there? Then you very readily might miss it. You know, you'll read in the textbooks that, you know, it enlarges towards the umbilicus, and that's the direction of travel as somebody breathes in, which is absolutely true. And I'm sure people will be aware that the sort of classic way for feeling for a spleen is to use the tips of your fingers, starting right down in the right iliac fossa, for those enormous spleens that we mentioned earlier on. Whereas if you start at the umbilicus, you will miss them because you're already on top of the spleen at that point. And paradoxically, some of those patients are quite stable and might end up in the exam. So starting right down in the right iliac fossa, coming up diagonally, and what you're doing is holding your hand still and asking the patient to take a deep breath in. And it's the movement of the spleen down onto your fingers that tells you it's there. There's no movement of your hand. It's all the movement of the spleen as they breathe into your hand. And then you're waiting for them to relax. And then you're moving your hand up and you're doing that sequentially. So you're going to do that initially when the patient is lying flat on their back. And then you're going to do some sort of a roll to try and bring the spleen towards you a bit. So some people will get the patient to roll sort of right over on their side. Some people will just put their hand lower than the ribs, because if your hands are on the ribs, you're not moving anything, but just kind of putting a bit of pressure from behind. I tend to do a bit of half and half and half, but you're just really encouraging that spleen to kind of fall downwards towards the middle of the abdomen so that you stand a better chance of feeling it. The spleen feels really smooth, like really smooth, and it's really round. I know you're supposed to feel a notch. Haven't felt a notch many times, but in contrast to the liver, where when you feel the liver, I don't know how you feel, but I tend to feel that the liver is a vertical wall coming towards my fingers, whereas the spleen is very much a curved thing where sometimes you kind of feel it and you kind of scoop over it as you're feeling. So again, it's just really concentrating on what are you feeling. They can be really really tricky to feel sometimes, even when you know that they're there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've put into words exactly something which I'd, you know, not even realized. But yeah, absolutely. When you do feel a spleen, it does sort of just, you almost sweep your hand almost over it. And that's why it's probably so easy for it to be missed by so many unfortunate candidates or listeners who get it in the exam.
Absolutely. And the minute that you've got a layer of subcutaneous fat there, it can be very, very difficult to feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned, we've already gone through parts of the palpation for the liver, but the spleen, I think it is just truly one extremely difficult, and there is no substitute for finding patients who have enlarged spleens in a ward environment, in hospital for your revision. I mean, I guess the other thing is, if you're saying every 10th patient or so, what are the chances of finding a patient in a haematology clinic, Susie? Is there any value in our listeners trying to get into their local haematology clinic to see if they, you know, they might get lucky and be able to feel some spleens there?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And also for no reason other than to see lots of people examining spleens and looking for lymph nodes, because everyone does it slightly differently. And even though with lymph nodes, you kind of think, well, the lymph nodes are there or they're not, aren't they? But actually, sometimes lymphadenopathy can be a bit tricky as well. So I think, as always, the more practice, the better. The more people you see do it, the more you can know and understand. The vast majority of people that are referred to haematology clinic do not have palpable spleens. So they'll have like a 14 centimeter spleen on imaging, and then you're kind of down there, how relevant is this path? But if you've got a friendly haematologist that does a general haematology clinic or a benign clinic, you know, I know who my patients are that have got big spleens. If someone emailed me, I'd be like, yeah, this person's coming on this day, come down, have a feel. So yeah, I think it's definitely worth, you know, don't spend months and months doing it, but if you've got somebody that you can approach, it's definitely worth a try, especially if you've never felt one, because once you've felt one, you kind of know what you're looking for. But if you've never felt one, it is quite difficult to visualize, and you don't want the first time you feel one to be in the exam.
Yeah, absolutely. You've taken the words right out of my mouth. And in fact, when I was at the Paces Ahead course recently, one of the things which became apparent is that they had so many patients there who had either rare signs or rare conditions. But it is one of those things that if you see it once, you will not forget it, and you will then be able to do it again or detect the sign again in future or name that condition in future. So yeah, absolutely, that does exist in your Paces revision. If you see something once, you detect that sign once, your chances of being confident about it in the exam go up tenfold.
And also, once you've felt one, you know what it feels like. And the problem sometimes, having said that, you've got to concentrate really hard, is sometimes you can imagine spleens when they're not there. So again, if you know what one feels like, you're kind of a bit more likely to have the courage of your convictions. And then I think probably the last thing that I would say about examining a spleen is that although we're taught this meticulous going up in the diagonal with your fingertips, if you think you feel one, don't be afraid to spend an extra couple of seconds. I know time is tight, but an extra couple of seconds with your hand behind, just having a good poke around from all of the angles, just trying to get all the way around it. Bearing in mind that one of the features of a spleen is you can't get above it if you're worried about a big kidney as your differential, for example. So don't be worried about using the side of your hand like you would do for a liver. Don't worry about coming, you know, right across the left side to have a good poke within the limits of the patient's comfort, of course. But yeah, if you think it's there, just have an extra bit of a prod. That's what I would do in practice anyway. That might be different in the exam, but that's what I would do.
I think within the limits of the patient's comfort is the buzz phrase there. And finally, moving to the legs of the patient, I mean, I didn't come up with a whole lot, Susie. The only thing I got was possibly a vasculitic rash, but even so, that's just so non-specific, isn't it? I just don't think there's much to find in the legs.
No, I agree. I mean, you might get edema in someone that's got bad liver failure, isn't it? But again, nothing much of too much interest, I would say.
Fantastic. So that should really complete your examination. And if you have detected a spleen, then you'll be expected to try and put it into one of these buckets of hematological, infiltrative, congestive, or infective or inflammatory. And Susie, one of the things I came across doing my reading was this table where it had been divided in three columns with mild, moderate, and massive splenomegaly. And I honestly don't think I actually found it that helpful, because it shoeboxes things into categories, which are sort of pretty arbitrary based on size and position of the spleen. And I don't know really if it helps us diagnostically particularly, but I wonder maybe it helps if the spleen is absolutely huge and is, as you mentioned, taking up the whole of the abdomen versus the mild and moderate, which I think is just a bit more of a grey area. But I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think, you know, as a purist, I always much prefer to think of things as to how they've arisen rather than how big they are. Like, you know, with anemia, I would much rather think about not enough production, destruction, you know, rather than high MCV, low MCV, because it doesn't actually tell you anything about what is going on underneath it all. I think, as you say, the main thing that's useful is that actually, because there's only four or five things that can cause an absolutely enormous spleen, and then if you've got an enormous spleen, then you're kind of home and dry, because it can only be one of a very small number of things. But I think for anything other than that, it's just really not that helpful.
Yeah, fantastic. And I guess the other thing, which we've already put a lot of emphasis on, feeling for lymph nodes. And when we talk about our causes of splenomegaly, I've got causes with nodes and then causes without nodes. And Susie, I sent you my list before the record, but I'm on tenterhooks as to whether or not the actual accuracy of my list is true. So I wonder, it could be a slight myth busting episode, but I wonder, maybe we can run through our hematological causes for with and without nodes, and you can tell me whether or not it's true or not.
Definitely. No, and your list is spot on, so don't worry. It's all good. So the key here is a little bit going back to what we were saying about at the beginning. Why is the spleen big? Also, the other thing I want to mention at this point, just to put things into context, is that when we're thinking about hematological causes, and people quite like to put them in a bucket because it's like hematology and it's a weird thing that people don't like very much, and there are just some diagnoses and we'll just learn those and then move on quickly before anyone asks us too much. But a little bit of knowledge is a powerful thing. And within your hematological causes, I really, really, really urge people to distinguish between lymphoid and myeloid. And you're thinking of lymphoid and myeloid in terms of lymphocytes and then your myelocytes, so like your neutrophils, obviously your most common. But you shouldn't forget that your, along with your neutrophils in your myeloid cells, are your red cells and your platelets, even though it's really counterintuitive. People think about the white cells and then they think about red cells and platelets as three different blood cells. But actually, you've got two different types of blood cells. You've got lymphoid and myeloid. And then within your myeloid, you're going to branch out into your neutrophils, your red cells and your platelets. If people think back to at medical school when we learned that horrendous diagram, or maybe we didn't learn it, but we just looked at it and turned the page, of hemopoiesis, you know, your pluripotent stem cell at the top, your hematopoietic stem cell. And very early on, you divide out into your lymphoid and your myeloid. Your lymphoid just literally goes down into your B cells and your T cells, and your myeloid goes down into your erythrocytes, your granulocytes, your megakaryocytes that become your platelets, and it divides out that early. So if you go back to your spleen with lymph nodes, that is your lymphoid system. So it might be a B cell problem, it might be a T cell problem, but it is a lymphoid problem. If you remove things like infection, which obviously in that context, your spleen is behaving like an honorary lymph node, and anything that can cause lymphadenopathy can potentially make your spleen big as well. But if you're thinking about sort of cancers and hematological problems, lymphoid, lymph nodes and big spleen. So it's going to be your lymphoma. It might be your ALL. It might be your CLL. They all go hand in hand. And it just depends where the lymphocyte is when it runs into problems and where it likes to hang out when it's proliferating, but your lymphocyte in various stages of development. You can get splenomegaly with myeloid problems, but when you get splenomegaly with myeloid problems, it's either because you need too much myeloid and the bone marrow can't cope with it. So that's your myeloproliferative disorders. So we're going to set up some extra hemopoiesis in the spleen because we're being told to make loads and loads and loads of myeloid cells and there's just not enough room in the bone marrow. Or it's because the bone marrow is full of something, breast cancer, whatever else. And so your hemopoiesis, your myelopoiesis, is having to evacuate the bone marrow and set up shop somewhere else. Or it's because you've got massive turnover of your myeloid cells, your hemolytic anemia, where your bone marrow is making lots and lots of red cells, but there's just not enough because they're being destroyed peripherally. And then you're going to pick up more hemopoiesis in the spleen. Also partly in that context, because your red cells are actually being destroyed in the spleen. So the spleen is doing extra work and it's going to get a bit big. Because of that, so it's a slightly hybrid example, but hopefully you can see where I'm coming from. So your lymph nodes plus a big spleen in the context of a hematological disorder, is going to be a lymphoid problem, but your big spleen without lymph nodes, probably a myeloid disorder. Of course, it could be a lymphoid disorder where the lymph nodes just don't happen to be big. But that's a little bit unfair.
I think that would be unfair. And I think probably at this bit, what I'm going to have to do is to, in the preamble for the show, I'm going to have to say, I highly recommend before listening that you go back and look at your blood cell family tree, so to speak, before you jump in, because otherwise people are just going to be very unhappy on their commutes listening and then thinking, oh my God, yeah, when was the last time I even thought about a pluripotent stem cell?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. So we're thinking about the hemolytic anemias, we're thinking about myeloproliferative diseases in the hematological causes without nodes. We obviously have covered hepatic congestive causes, covered off, well, much of episode 67. And if there are signs consistent with chronic liver disease, then, you know, and I guess the other thing to say is that by far and away, if you palpate a spleen and you can't feel a liver, which is actually much more common, because the liver actually shrinks and sort of shies away from where you would typically examine, you may be likely to find a spleen without any hepatomegaly, and that would be, you know, well in keeping with chronic liver disease as well and portal hypertension. But then we get to another one of our categorical buckets, Susie, which is infection. And I actually think probably I have felt more infected or spleens that are reactive to an infection than probably most of what we've spoken about so far, maybe with the exception of chronic liver disease. But I've definitely, the first time I've detected spleens has been, majority of times, and these are just the ones that jump out to me, have been young patients with EBV, with glandular fever. That's just something we've come across in same day emergency or the medical take. But again, the infective causes are something that we definitely ought to have in our armory to be able to talk about.
Absolutely. And that's where your history is going to come in more, isn't it? In terms of if people are having, infective symptoms, I guess fevers and sweats can be a sign of hematological disease, but also infection. The travel history is really important for me. And then I'm afraid, am I allowed to be rude to my infectious diseases colleagues? It basically just comes down to requesting a panel of tests, irrespective of the information that you've got. So the things that we tend to look for, as you say, CMV, EBV, always think about things like leishmaniasis. So I've diagnosed leishmaniasis in somebody that had only been to Portugal once 40 years ago. So you don't have to have a particularly exciting travel history to diagnose leishmaniasis. He presented with HLH, actually. It was quite interesting. And then things like brucellosis can do it. And then you've got your old favourite, malaria, where you then come into requesting your thick and thin films. But usually there's a little bit more to go on in terms of the history and suggestive symptoms and signs for malaria.
Listeners, I'm delighted to welcome a brand new podcast partner, Scrubs, in all caps, S-C-R-B-S. This company is run by two GPs and they make awesome scrubs. I've been wearing mine for a couple of weeks now and they absolutely strike the balance between being comfortable, functional and appearing professional at work at a decent price. And they're even more affordable when you use the discount code PACES10 to get 10% off any order. Just head to scrubs.co.uk, scrubs.co.uk, and use the code PACES10 for 10% off your order at the checkout. Yeah, absolutely. And then we've got the inflammatory causes. We mentioned about Felties at the start of the show with rheumatoid changes in the hands, joint arthropathies as well. You can also get it with things like lupus. So always think about SLE if there are suggestive skin rashes that you've found during the course of your examination as well. And then we get to the real fine small print, Susie, at the end, is the infiltrative causes. And you mentioned a couple of these as well as at the start, things like sarcoid, amyloidosis. I mean, are these patients that fit in the category of stable enlarged spleens the types that would be able to come in for the exam?
Probably. Well, your sarcoid may well do. Again, I'm not a respiratory physician and I would leave it to them to comment, but certainly, some patients with sarcoid won't need treatment straight away. If they've got a palpable spleen, they might be fair game. And of course, you might get lymphadenopathy associated with that as well. Your Gaucher's patients, can have quite big spleens. They do get treated, but they may have a big spleen for, you know, a significant period of time. They tend to be fairly well. So that would be fair enough. So yeah, we can see them. The amyloids, I think less so, they tend to be pretty unwell by the time they finally get diagnosed. Late diagnosis is a massive issue for them, and they usually got heart failure and all sorts of other terrible things going on. So unlikely to see them, but not impossible.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, Susie, one of the things which I thought is, well, we have already touched on it maybe at the start of the show, but when these patients are referred to your clinic and you end up seeing them, what are the sorts of symptoms that they're usually report to you? I mean, I appreciate you said, you know, a lot of them are asymptomatic and found incidentally on imaging, but do you ever get to tease out any of the typical symptoms that are associated with patients who have splenomegaly?
I think it all depends on the underlying cause. I'm trying to think the last time I actually had someone with a big spleen where they had a satisfying logical explanation for the big spleen. Half the time they turn out to have liver disease, which is usually a case of trying to persuade the liver team that they've got liver disease.
I think it probably is a lot of the stuff we talked about earlier. You know, is it actually from the enlargement itself, such as the bloating or early satiety, or is it actually related to the cytopenias that, you know, that are associated, which I guess we have sort of already discussed as well?
Yeah, and you know, most of the time, if they have got symptoms, it's going to be because of the underlying condition. So it's going to be because of the, you know, rampant lymphoma that they've got, or any of the other things. You know, your malaria patient, we haven't talked about things like HLH, because obviously that's going to happen much more acutely, but often those patients are going to have, you know, the spleen is going to be something you find rather than the presenting complaint in those sorts of conditions most commonly.
And I think just one more bit on this before we then move on to our investigations and management is the, if we nip back quickly to the table of mild, moderate and massive splenomegaly. Mm. So the massive bit is the column which I most confidently remember, because I think if it's massive, it's only a set few things. And the four that I have down, which I've seen consistently across, you know, a lot of the revision resources that I found, are the hematological. So I've got these are the myeloid causes. So you'd not expect them to have associated lymphadenopathy. It's myelofibrosis, CML. And then on the infective side, I've got malaria and then visceral leishmaniasis. And those are the ones which by and large I've come across. Is that more or less concordant with your clinical experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just thinking about a time when we had a patient who was referred with a big spleen. It was an inpatient, and they got referred to us because the radiology report from the CT said enormous splenomegaly query CML in a patient that had a completely normal full blood count, or they're probably a tiny bit thrombocytopenic because I had a massive spleen. So just a reminder to everyone to put all the pieces together. You can't have CML with a normal full blood count. And you're unlikely to have myelofibrosis with a normal full blood count as well. Your leishmaniasis should be pretty apparent clinically by the time you've got a massive spleen, and the same with your malaria. So with those big causes, or those causes of a very big spleen, there should be some very helpful clues along the way.
And I have to be honest, I think the mild and moderate I find very difficult to tease out clinically. I think if you're feeling it, it could be any of the ones that fit into either of those categories. And that is basically anything that we've mentioned that doesn't include the four diagnoses that go in the massive category.
I agree. And I also, I think you previously made the point that a big spleen had to be a small spleen at some point. So, you know, just because it's a cause of a massive doesn't mean it can't be a cause of a mild or a moderate. And also, you know, if you look at the things on the mild or the moderate, I've certainly seen EBV with a pretty sizable spleen. So although that goes down as mild, because it will be in most people, it doesn't mean it can't cause moderate splenomegaly. So I think it's very difficult to be too clear about those.
Yeah, absolutely. Righto. So we're moving on to the investigations now. And so we are going to approach this again with a hematological lilt. And that is because we've already gone through the chronic liver disease workup in that episode. So you'll have to go to part two of our chronic liver disease, which is episode 68. Susie, we're going to talk about working these patients up, or the examiner discussion afterwards. So again, this is where PACE becomes a bit contrived, because rather than an incidental finding on imaging that then you go back and examine, and you say, oh yes, they've got a big spleen, you're expected to, I guess the first thing would be confirm your suspicions with a form of imaging.
Absolutely, yeah, and you know, ultrasound would be absolutely fine. It's actually a bit easier to get a measurement on a spleen with an ultrasound, and that would be our first port of call. You're practically speaking, you're going to get a really good assessment of your liver on ultrasound, so it is very helpful from that perspective. Arguably, you want to know whether the patient's got lymphadenopathy, because if you've not felt any clinically, you're going to need to do some imaging to see if there's anything that you're not able to feel. And if you have felt some clinically, you're going to need to do some imaging to look at the extent of it. So in many ways, you could say, well, go straight to CT, because you're going to get, you know, everything that you need. But yeah, you can argue it either way. I don't think an examiner would be in a place to say that one was right and the other one was wrong, to a degree, depending on what else you found.
And then your other investigations, I guess, are going to be looking for the underlying cause. And I guess part of that is, well, a critical part of that is your full blood count, where you're going to find all the, you know, potentially a pancytopenia. But it could be anything, depending on what else you found in the examination.
It could be everything and anything, could be high or low, exactly. And I mean, starting with the platelet count, which you would expect to be low in someone with a big spleen. So if you want a nice easy mark without having to worry about what you think you may or may not have found in terms of underlying cause, then, you know, a full blood count, because I would expect this patient to have a low platelet count because they've got a big spleen. The platelets get sequestered in the spleen. So irrespective of anything else that's going on, you would expect to get a low platelet count in sort of significant splenomegaly. And then, as you say, your full blood count is going to help you decide, has the patient got hemolytic anemia? Has the patient got CML with a, you know, very high neutrophil count? Has the patient got a myeloproliferative disorder with a high hematocrit, we talked about before, or a high platelet count? All sorts of things that you're going to be able to tell from your full blood count. The one thing you cannot diagnose from your full blood count is lymphoma, just so you know. So with lymphoma, the point is that it's the lymph nodes that get enlarged rather than the circulating lymphocytes in the blood. You will be able to diagnose CLL from your blood test. Well, you're going to get an idea, because you're going to get a high lymphocyte count. And of course, the later stages in CLL, you can get big lymph nodes and a big spleen. But yeah, your full blood count is going to be really important. And then also you can say a full blood count and blood film. So without going into too much detail, there are certain telltale signs on a film for a myeloproliferative disorder. You can basically diagnose CML on a film, because it's not mature neutrophils that you see. You see lots of mature neutrophils, but you also see lots of precursors, which should not be in the peripheral blood. And that's a really classic finding. Again, wary of asking for a blood film for lymphoma, because the lymph nodes should be where the abnormal lymphocytes are rather than in the blood. A few exceptions to that, as always. But again, CLL, you should see your characteristic small round lymphocytes with smear cells on your blood film. So yeah, full blood count and blood film. And there are lots of things that you can say from a hematological perspective. You don't have to say them all, but just a couple of flavors of things that you might be looking for.
Yeah, I guess the other thing is inflammatory markers. I mean, you know, we've talked about white cell count, neutrophils and lymphocytes, but a CRP, maybe an ESR for infection or inflammation for those inflammatory or infective causes might be helpful, at least because in the exam you're not going to know, but it's going to be important from an investigation perspective to mention that.
Absolutely, yeah. And then in terms of your wider kind of spectrum of tests, as you throw that net out, you're going to do your liver function, looking for your liver, which we probably don't need to go into too much detail about here. But the really important thing from my perspective that you get on that blood test is the bilirubin, which might throw you a bit of a line in terms of hemolytic anemia. So I would just do a full hemolysis screen in everybody that comes with a slightly big spleen. So it's going to be your bilirubin, your LDH, so non-specific marker of cell turnover, it's going to go up in hemolysis, your haptoglobin, which is a very special protein whose job it is to scavenge free heme, which is what falls out of the red cell when it gets broken down. It's a very confusing one, because you think it would go up if it's, you know, really important, but actually it goes down. You don't have much of it. It doesn't take much to saturate it. So haptoglobin is usually undetectable in hemolysis, and all of those are biochemistry tests. And then you've got your hematology test, which is going to be your reticulocytes. They're going to be the most important. That's your young red blood cells. So if your marrow is working well, you're making good red blood cells, but they're just being destroyed too quickly, irrespective of the reason, any cause of hemolytic anemia. If your marrow is working well, your reticulocytes will go up in compensation. That just shows the marrow is working well, kicking out loads of red cells. And then your other hematology test is the DAT, which I know people love to talk about, the DAT or the Coombs test, the direct antiglobulin test. And that is part of your hemolysis screen. What it does not do is tell you whether the patient is hemolyzing. But if the patient is hemolyzing, then it gives you a clue as to whether that hemolysis is immune or not immune. So you could have hemolysis, for example, because you've got someone with a really narrow aortic valve right in your neck of the woods, Sam. Someone's got a really, really narrow aortic valve and they're hemolyzing through that just because their pressure is so high across the valve. The red cells are bursting as they go through. Your hemolysis markers will be exactly as we've said, high bilirubin, high LDH, low haptoglobin, high retics, but the DAT will be negative because there are no antibodies in those red cells. It's nothing to do with the immune system. But if you've got autoimmune hemolytic anemia, the mechanism is that you're getting antibodies sticking on the red cells, flagging them for destruction. And when you do your DAT, you're looking for antibodies on the surface of the red cells. So if your hemolysis screen is positive, you do a DAT as part of it. DAT is positive, then you're thinking it's an immune cause. If it's negative, you're thinking it's a non-immune cause. And also just to say, one of my favorite facts is that 15% of hospital inpatients will have a positive DAT. If they're not hemolyzing, I do not care in the nicest possible way. So you're allowed to have a positive DAT. The critical thing is whether you've got evidence of hemolysis. So that's your word of caution with the DAT. I know that was a bit of a hairdryer moment of facts in your face. But that's the thing with the DAT, is it's really helpful to decide the cause of hemolysis. But if someone is not hemolyzing, if it's positive, it's unlikely to be of too much relevance.
Yeah. So critically, you've got to have biochemical evidence of hemolysis for a DAT or a Coombs test to even be relevant.
Exactly. Exactly. And then also just talking about hemolysis tests and tests that we've already done, actually, is going to be your blood film, because in hemolytic anemia, your blood film is going to really help you to decide the cause of the hemolytic anemia. It'll certainly give you some really important clues.
Yeah, fantastic. And then I guess the other thing is talking about other imaging, which is less specific for the spleen, but would help us in our diagnostic process for some of the causes we've talked about. And so something that is almost used as a screening test is a chest X-ray looking for bilateral hilar lymphadenopathy for lymphoma. I mean, would you recommend that if you've got a patient with a large spleen and nodes? Would you recommend that as something the candidates should mention?
I mean, practically speaking, I wouldn't, because if I actually genuinely am worried someone's got lymphoma, they're going to get a CT scan in this day and age. I mean, your chest X-ray might be useful in someone you think might have sarcoid. I guess a lot of patients, especially if they're coming in on the medical take, are going to get a chest X-ray anyway. But if the examiner is asking for tests that are going to definitively help you move down one pathway or the other, chest X-ray is probably not top of my list. But, you know, you could mention if the patient has had a chest X-ray, I would look for bilateral hilar lymphadenopathy if it's there on something that's already available. Again, it's not wrong to say it, but in practice, that's not what we would routinely do.
Yeah. And would that routinely be just a full body CT, or how often do you use a PET CT in patients like this as well?
Yeah, so we would usually start with a CT for sort of diagnostic purposes, because your PET CT doesn't tell you much about the lymph nodes. It just tells you whether they're hot or not. So it's definitely a very important part of staging once you've made a diagnosis, or if you've got a patient that's got lots of lymph nodes and you're not really sure if they're reactive or like what's going on with them, and you've got a kind of diagnostic dilemma in someone that's got lymphadenopathy, then you might do a PET at that point. And we're sort of using PET a lot more than you know, we did 10 years ago. But CT would usually be the first port of call. And personally, I'm a fan of the chest, abdomen, pelvis. I don't see the need to do the neck, because you can examine that, but you'll see plenty of people requesting a neck, chest, abdomen, pelvis, partly because once the patient's got lymphoma, you want to have a baseline to compare to in terms of response to treatment and things. So I sort of have a bit of sympathy for that. But as someone that doesn't treat lymphoma as part of my day job, I don't tend to do the neck up front unless I'm pretty concerned that that's definitely what they're going to have.
And how relevant is something like a bone marrow aspirate and trephine, or I mean, a lymph node biopsy for those patients, I guess, is very important, because that's going to be absolutely diagnostic.
Yeah.
But I mean, these sort of specialist tests, how relevant are they in our workup?
Yeah, so we discussed this in our MDT today, this very question, actually, and I'm about to do a bone marrow biopsy on someone where it's almost certainly going to be normal, but they've got a big spleen, and what else are you going to do? As we said, you know, with the myeloid causes of a big spleen, it's usually really obvious from the full blood count that they've got something myeloid going on, because they've got something wrong with their red cells, their neutrophils, or their platelets. You can get caught out sometimes with the lymphoid ones if they don't happen to have big lymph nodes. You could have a big spleen and you might be lucky enough to pick up just a few abnormal lymphocytes on your bone marrow to make a diagnosis. But it's pretty rare. I don't think I've ever done a bone marrow biopsy in someone with a big spleen. and it's made the diagnosis, we would do it for the sake of completeness. But I think it's a common misconception amongst non-hematologists that the bone marrow is really, really helpful because it's looking for hematological disorders. But actually, it's rare that you get information from the bone marrow that you didn't already have from the full blood count.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably just because we don't do them. And occasionally when we get a hematology opinion, what sometimes in the plan is to do a bone marrow, and we think, oh, that's clever because we can't do that.
Yeah.
Only you could do that.
But also, and I know people don't like my sort of hematopoietic stem cell situation explanation, but actually because although you do have lymphoid cells in the bone marrow, but it's not their primary place of maturation and it's not where they live, it's not where they do their work. The bone marrow is the home of the myeloid system and the lymph node, and the spleen is the home of the lymphoid system. So actually, if you've got a lymphoid problem, you're looking in a myeloid space. So you kind of almost have to think of hematology as two completely different systems, lymphoid and myeloid. And yes, there is a little bit of overlap, but not as much as people might think.
Brilliant. Are there any other investigations in terms of a hematological diagnosis, or have we pretty much exhausted our options?
I mean, we've pretty much done it. I mean, I do tend to send peripheral blood peripheral blood flow cytometry looking for a lymphoid clone, but that's kind of clutching at straws just because it's non-invasive, it's easy to do. So you're looking for your kind of weird lymphomas with that. You would pick up CLL classically by doing that, but if they've got CLL, their lymphocyte count is high in their peripheral blood. So again, you would do it if you had a lead from your full blood count, but if you haven't got a lead from your full blood count, it's unlikely to yield anything of much help. You can get some very funny lymphomas that present with you know, very little by way of lymphadenopathy. And then the only thing that you're really left with, which was the discussion that we had today, was at what point do you actually do a spleen biopsy? Because you can. You might not want to, but you can. So it's going to come with a really high bleeding risk, like a really high bleeding risk. So we would really reserve that for people who, you know, have had everything else done and there's really clearly something very wrong. So a spleen that continues to enlarge on sequential imaging, systemic symptoms, and where everything else that you've done is unhelpful and not giving you an answer. But that's very much, you know, specialist hematology territory. And I can certainly count on one hand the number of times I've seen that done. Not something that we want to encourage people to be talking about in faces too much.
Yeah, brilliant. We've exhausted hematology, I think, but it would still probably be important to mention the other causes in terms of investigations for chronic liver disease. You can find all of those in that previous episode. Infection wise, we've talked about thick and thin films of malaria. If it's massive, and we talked about visceral leishmaniasis, the diagnostic investigation I have is actually from a bone marrow biopsy, or one of them I found is either histology from a skin lesion or a bone marrow biopsy. So either way, you might be hitting two birds with one stone.
Yeah, absolutely. You can also do serology these days for leishmaniasis. And certainly the case that I saw, the histopathologist was absolutely devastated because he didn't see it on the slide. So yeah, it was there when we went back. But yeah, you can do serology as well, which is helpful in that, you know, you can do your brucellosis serology and all of that as well in terms of non-invasive testing. So I tend to do that as my second line things. Might have a quick chat with an ID physician, tell them the travel history and anything else that I should be so that they can sort of mention any weird and wonderful things that I might not have on my radar as well. But it's often, I guess it's the way in many medical specialties, but it feels like particularly in hematology, it's the trade-off between the likelihood of getting an answer versus how invasive you have to be. So sometimes we look for some quite rare things up front just because it stops you having to stick a big needle in someone's bone marrow. And obviously a bone marrow biopsy before a spleen biopsy for sure.
Yeah, brilliant. And I mean, the only other things I've got left are the inflammatory causes. I mean, pick your preferred autoimmune diagnosis and investigate with the appropriate autoimmune panel. You can go back to the rheumatoid arthritis episode. You can go back to the ankylosing spondylitis episode and listen through those. But by and large, that's going to be an autoimmune panel. And I guess the only other thing, Susie, we haven't actually mentioned is about the management of these patients. But I just think it is so dependent on the clinical presentation. I think it is going to have to be almost a case of you suspect this is a hematological diagnosis, you would ask for the advice of a hematologist. I don't think the expectation from PACES is for you to know exactly how to manage these patients. I think it probably would be sufficient to signpost to the appropriate team because you found the correct signs.
I completely agree. You know, you can't give a treatment for splenomegaly. There's no treatment for the, I mean, it's a symptom basically, isn't it? And it's all about finding the underlying cause for sure. And I think the other thing, just to go back to the inflammatory causes, is that rheumatologists may disagree, but from my perspective, you're not going to get a big spleen as your first presentation of rheumatoid, or as, you know, SLE, or maybe SLE because it's a funny one, isn't it? But for the vast majority, your ankylosing spondylitis, those other symptoms are going to be there. You might be the one that finds them, I suppose, if you've got a patient that isn't presenting in a kind of a typical way, but your splenomegaly is not going to be the only thing that's wrong with that person if the cause of it is your kind of your ankylosing spond or your rheumatoid. And it's very rare that those spleens are that big, with the exception of Felty's, where they can be sort of pretty reasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. And completely agree. But Susie, I think we've almost come to the end of our discussion on splenomegaly. Did you have any final thoughts or closing thoughts for our listeners in this really, really difficult station?
I don't think so. I think we've talked about it. I think just know that it is a difficult topic. Try and gather the sort of basic principles and understand that sort of anything that you find might be relevant. Think about what's making the spleen big, and hopefully that will help you to kind of bring your thoughts together. But yeah, it's a tricky one in the exam and in real life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will be thoroughly dusting off my pluripotent stem cell diagram before I go back.
I can find you a mouse mat if you want one.
Post it to me, Susie. Well, listeners, that brings us to the end of another episode, and that just leaves us to say a huge thank you to Dr. Susie Morton, consultant hematologist. And this time we've saved you from the Taylor Swift quiz, Susie. We thought we'd spare it for you on this occasion.
I think I'm not the only one that's glad about that, Sam.
Susie, thank you so much for joining me again.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
But listeners, that is just about all the time we've got for this week's show. Please don't forget, you can like, follow and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please do get in touch. You can do that through the usual means on the social media. That's at Prepaces Podcast on Twitter or via the website. And if you really want to go above and beyond, you can support the show at buymeacoffee.com/Prepaces Podcast. But for now, we are just about out of time. I've been Dr. Sam Williams. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Pre Paces Podcast.